Good morning. Good to see you. It's a cozy little group today. Well, you know, we're going to have two Zazen and Dharma talks starting in January. So you may have a variety of thoughts and feelings about that. But it does seem to be a reasonable response to me to the number of human beings in this space right now. So I hope it turns out to be supportive and encouraging to your practice and our ability to practice as a community as well. I'm going to talk a little bit more about the Gandavyuha chapter of the Avatamsaka Sutra. I just like saying that because it makes me sound really knowledgeable. I actually practice saying these big words. So we've been studying this. We just finished up a six session study group on this particular text. And I'd just like to thank all the people who were part of that study group. It was just really wonderful to have the opportunity to dive into the text together. And these Buddhist texts can be really challenging. And so, you know, textual study is not for everybody. But by coming together and doing it, something emerges out of the group consciousness that just cannot emerge from a single mind engaging with the text. And people were really willing to kind of be challenged and be real. And it was wonderful. So thank you to the members of that group. The Avatamsaka Sutra is a very large piece of literature that was very influential on Zen. To put it really simply, the emphasis of the text is interdependence and interconnection. And for some people, you think, I thought that's what all Buddhism was about. But actually, different types of Buddhism really emphasize different things. So a lot of people would say the Avatamsaka Sutra is like the most interdependence, interconnection emphasizing piece of literature that we have. And the Gandavyuha chapter is the last chapter, and it's just about one young man who feels an aspiration to give his life to liberation for everybody from suffering, and then just keeps going from teacher to teacher, and every teacher gives him this amazing teachings, and he has amazing realizations, and he just keeps going. So the message of this is one that this impulse, this request that some of us find to offer our lives to the well-being of everyone can be such a powerful driver, and that we have to keep going, and that we need support and encouragement to remind us of that value, of that part of ourselves, which can be kind of like obscured or ignored. So anyway, I want to move to a very particular part of this text. So Sudana is the pilgrim, and he meets all these different teachers, and he meets this night goddess. I can't resist reading you her name. The people who are in the study group are really going to love this. So her name is Sarva Jagadraga Shaksa Prana Dana Virya Prabha. This is Mahayana Buddhism, so the thing is, each one of you made that up however you experienced it. So anyway, he meets this night goddess. She gives him a bunch of really beautiful teachings. They have this profound connection. And then she says, I'm going to tell you a story. And she tells this story about a prince who devotes himself to liberating a particular group of people from suffering. And then at the end, she says, oh, by the way, I was that prince. And I just love this in that, you know, when you do something really wonderful, or, you know, you can, oh, no, I couldn't talk about that. Or, you know, you might think, I wouldn't want to elevate that too much. But she's so non-identified with any part of her history or herself that she can talk about something wonderful, just like, look at that. How wonderful was that? And she doesn't, but we see other people in this text who in the same way can talk about things they did that were harmful and just be like, look at that. So normally, when we relate to our own histories, there's all this activation. There's, we might resist the things that we did for harmful or try and deny them, or maybe we obsess about them and get absorbed in shame about them, or we can't talk honestly about the things we did that were wonderful. And these people show this sense of just like, that's just what happened. What can we learn from it? Is this beneficial? Is it harmful? And in this case, from the story she will tell, it's pretty clear she thinks that it was beneficial. So I'm going to read a section of this text, and it's a little bit long, so I'll be reading for about 5 minutes. So it's like story time. And I just invite you to let yourself just be immersed in this story. You could say it has a lot of mythic power. There's elements of the fantastic within it. Yeah, it's dramatic, I'll tell you that. At that time, there was a king called Victorious Light in the capital city named Array of Delights. He had thrown many hundreds of thousands of criminals and evildoers into prison to discipline them. Thieves, killers, rapists, liars, abusive and violent people, troublemakers, greedy people, malicious people, people obsessed with aberrant ideas, people addicted to unlawful pleasures, people overcome by desire for ill-gotten gains, people involved in false cults, people who had committed violence, people who had done no good, people who had neglected to come to the aid of those in danger and fear, people without respect for their parents or for mendicants, priests, and holy people. The king had a son named Conqueror, who had 28 of the marks of a great man and lived in the palace. He heard the frightful cries of those who were bound up in prison. Agitated and upset by these cries, moved with compassion, he left the palace and went into the prison, where he saw those peoples cast into the dungeons, bound by all sorts of fetters and shackles, chained together and thrown into the darkness, shrouded in smoke, exposed to unhealthy drafts, emaciated, hungry and thirsty, naked and homeless, filthy and unkempt, being subjected to tortures and screaming in pain. Seeing the prisoners, the prince was inspired with great compassion and unprecedented determination to help. He comforted the prisoners, intending to deliver them from their bonds. Giving them assurance, he went to the king and said, "Know, O king, that I have given assurance to the people in prison. Please set them free." The king called his 500 ministers together and asked them what they thought about this. They said, "These people are plunderers of the royal treasures, attackers of the king, arrested entering the royal palace. They should be executed. Furthermore, anyone who wants to save them is also guilty of crime against the king." The prince, overwhelmed with great compassion, said to those ministers, "Let it be as you say. Just release the convicts. I can all endure all the pains for their sake. Whatever you do to them, do to me. To free them from bondage, I will undergo all kinds of torture and give up my body and life. Why? If I cannot liberate these people from bondage, how can I liberate those who are bound to the world, who are tied up by the ropes of craving, who are in the abyss of ignorance, who are cast into the darkness of delusion, who suffer the pains of poverty, who have fallen into the depths of evil ways, who are senseless, who act senselessly, whose minds are confused, who see no way to emancipation, who are attached to the world, who lack virtue and knowledge, who have lost their faculties of knowledge, whose minds are tainted with afflictions, who are flung in the mud of suffering, who are tormented by birth, old age, death, grief, lamentation, misery, depression, and sorrow." Then the prince released all those prisoners for their bonds by giving up himself, his whole retinue, and all his wealth. Freeing them, he removed all that was torturing them once and for all. At that point, the 500 ministers, up in arms, went to the king and said, "Know that the law of the king has been broken by the will of the prince, and all our lives are uncertain. If you do not punish the prince, your own life will not last long." The king, enraged, set out to kill his son and those convicts as well. The queen, hearing of this, was very upset. Her hair undone, her jewelry and makeup removed, she went to the king with 1,000 of her ladies, beating her breast and throwing dust on her head, weeping and wailing. She said to him, "Let the prince go free. Let him live." The king turned to the prince and said, "Give up on these criminals. If you do not, you will die for their sake." The prince, facing death, was not fazed. Being focused on universal liberation, dedicated to the welfare of all, guided by great compassion, the queen, his mother, asked the king to allow a fortnight for observation. Let the prince give people whatever they need for half a month, then do whatever you want with him. The king agreed to this. North of the city, there was a large park called Sunlight that had been made in the past as a sacrificial ground. The prince went there and gave to anyone who asked whatever they needed. Thus, for half a month, he freely gave away various goods, food, clothing, utensils, and so on, to whoever needed them. So then the text actually gets really elaborate. And the Buddha shows up because he says, these people really appear to be ready to learn something. And he talks to them about how things arise from causes and conditions, that putting affliction into the world causes suffering, and putting kindness into the world produces well-being. And then this is the point at which the woman with a really long name reveals herself to have been the prince. And then they go on and elucidate how all the people involved in this story go on to practice for the liberation of everyone and attain fantastic states of liberation. Sounds good. So we see all these different kinds of people with these different narratives within the story ultimately are transformed. Everybody has this liberative capacity. You may think everybody else has the liberative capacity, or you may think, ooh, we have the liberative capacity and the people with the other way of looking at it don't. You may oscillate between those two views. But this story is about how everyone has this capacity. So I want to talk about the people in this story in terms of aspects of ourselves. You know, they say in dreams, everything you see is an aspect of yourself. How could that not be true? Anyway, so I want to start with the king and his ministers. Angry, punitive, and judgmental. Is this an aspect of yourself? It certainly is an aspect of myself. I can see it come up, and it's various where it will show up. There'll be sometimes someone will appear, and I'll just be like, they're so wrong. You know, they deserve to be insulted, you know, give them some bad names. Or maybe an aspect of my own self will come up, and I want to shunt it away. If I can't ignore it, I might want to destroy it. We see this very subtly in the practice of Zazen. You have a thought come up, and sometimes you're like, And other times you're like, stupid thoughts! This is actually the king. The king wants to punish, get rid of, and control to protect himself. If you go further in the story, remember the ministers say, you will be destroyed. The crime these people have done is to violate you. This angry, punitive thing is a self-protective shell. And we can see it if we have feelings come up and we want to sort of banish them, crush them or squash them. So this tendency of responding with sort of anger, control, punishment permeates everything from little subtle moments of our consciousness to really big elements of our engagement with the world. And in this story, the king is like this, his ministers like this, and what happens? They all commit to the path of realization and attain realization. How about that? So this is kind of cool. It's a very powerful convention of storytelling. If you analyze stories from many cultures, generally speaking, someone is expelled at the end. Someone evil is expelled, punished. And so in this story, it's like, oh, there's this angry, punitive, violent, self-defensive energy, and we'll just meet it with how we are, and then liberation is possible. So you don't have to destroy or attack this part of yourself, because that's actually doing the same thing. Recognize it and touch it with that part of ourselves that believes in the possibility of universal liberation. So then there are these prisoners who are subjected. There's this long list of things. And it's interesting to see, it would be interesting to know everyone here's reaction when the list is going. What I remember from the study group is someone said, wow, you started with murderers, and by the end it was people who don't respect their parents. Seems like a pretty big range, right? So in this story, the degree of criminality or the degree of harm is flattened. It's flattened out. Towards the end, it's just like people who are covetous. So this flattening is not like the only useful way of looking at the situation, but it's a powerful touchstone for how we usually view harmful things. We want to be able to like sort of judge they're the bad people and they're the good. I'm okay. I might be really judgmental, but at least I'm not whatever it is. And everyone has different sort of levels of where everyone has to be expelled. There's a certain category of person that is outside. And this just says, flattens it out. So I recall when I used to provide meditation instruction at Moose Lake Prison, I have no idea what the people in there had done that had caused them to be incarcerated. I never did. And that was an opportunity to just be like, we're just here. We all have the capacity for doing something liberative, and that's what we're going to do right now. And that was powerful. People who have been put into a category of outside the sphere, it's powerful for them to be included in humanity. In humanity. It's not the only way of looking at it, but it's a powerful antidote to our constant cutting, self-protecting, judging, punitive training. So I just like to say, want to honor your reactivity. So there may be like some categories of people that were listed in the text that you're like, that is not okay to flatten that out. So I honor that. That's a valid way of looking at it, an experience that you're having that's worth taking care of. By the way, if you want to spend some time with people who are incarcerated, the opportunity is here. We have a group of people who go to a variety of prisons as well as juvenile detention center here in Hennepin County. And I think they may need volunteers. I mean, we're looking for people who have a substantial amount of experience with meditation so you can actually effectively support people. But if you're interested, feel free to let me know. Or is there anyone else who's coordinating this who's interested in? I think our normal person who's most involved is ill today. Matt Sisler. A couple other people. Anyway, so you can do this. You can do this. So I will say this book kind of presents this flat thing, and the prison environment is, you know, looks pretty horrible. Prison environments are pretty horrible in my experience. They're not as bad as the one described here, but it's, you know, it's not good. And kind of a tangent, but I just remember distinctly. So I teach secular mindfulness meditation in many contexts. So, and what one thing I've really distinctly noticed is, like, what I'm teaching police, I say, all right, find a long spine, and they're all just like, meep. And then when I go to, like, a halfway house or a treatment center, it's like, find a long spine, and people are like, And I remember when I was in prison, almost no one could sit up. They couldn't do it. The conditions of being excluded are so powerful, they become embodied and are really challenging to challenge internally. You can just see it. So, in case it's not, I differ that this piece of literature is a piece of literature that's got mythic power and stuff, but I do think it is important and valuable to, if people do things harmful, to find a way to limit their ability to harm other people. And that is an important function that we can do personally in relationships with people. If someone is doing something harmful, to set some boundaries and create context where to limit their capacity to continue to do that. And in prisons and correctional facilities in the United States have that function. But in case it's not apparent to you, they have a lot of other functions that have nothing to do with just limiting people's capacity to do harm. They are the framework that you hear about is frequently punitive, and it's about harming people. Why is that helpful? I got to say, why is harming people helpful? I don't think it is. So I agree with the text in this regard. So anyway, then you have the prince. So looking at the prince, you know, the first thing he does is he goes where the suffering is. He's like, hears about the suffering. And he doesn't say, wow, there are people screaming down there. My palace sure is nice. He's like, what's going on down there? And then he goes straight to where it is and is touched. And is touched. Something kind of amazing is happening in the U.S. of A. Is that some people, you know, well, I mean, there's this long-standing movement, but, you know, there was an increasing amount of energy put by a small number of people on the fact that the criminal justice system we have here was putting huge amounts of people in prison. So we have the largest prison population in the world and the highest per capita prison population in the world in the U.S., higher than North Korea, China, countries that you think are really, really oppressive. So which country is oppressive? And in case you're not also aware, the incarcerated population is very highly disproportionately people of color, in particular African-American people, and there's huge amounts of evidence that that is not because they do more criminal acts. So, anyway, just thought I'd put that out there, since we're talking about prisons. It's not just like, oh, those happen in old stories. But anyway, people started noticing this, and there's actually change happening. There is actually a substantial amount of change happening in the country. People can go, oh, this is really harmful, and people are being hurt, and you can talk about it, and it's kind of hard to have the conversation, and then people change. It's possible. So, bipartisan bill in Congress that looks like it's going to move forward to make at least some changes. More work to do. But, you know, I think it's possible that some people in this room may think, the problems of our culture are so intractably bad, I just give up. That's not what the prince does. The prince hears the suffering, he goes there, and is just touched. Wow. And then is immediately like, oh, well, this isn't right. We'll set you free. He goes to his dad. He says, well, set him free. They're like, no. And he's like, oh, well, then I'll just, then do all the punishment on me. Now, that's really the point at which this story, you go, wow, that's an unconventional way of being. And he's pretty persistent in this, right? He's just like, yep, okay, just kill me. I'll be fine. Because he's realized he's connected to everybody. He just really realizes that he's connected to everything. And then towards the end, you know, it's like, oh, well, let's just give people food and clothing and shelter. Oh, but that would disempower them. Isn't that the message of the U.S. of A.? If you give people food, it takes away the dignity of their own labor. That's not his attitude. So this kind of hearing the pain and going towards it is by no means the whole of or even the emphasis of the practice of Zazen or the practice of Zen that we cultivate here, but it is a distinct and evident part of it. If you are just like, I just thought I would do meditation and chill out a little bit and then like maybe I would have some mild health benefits because I read about that in InShape magazine. That is cool and all those things may happen. But that is really not at all the idea of this tradition that we are upholding. So I've kind of heartened to see that people come in the door, and I think a lot of people sort of come to the Zen Center. They're like, oh, yeah, I've heard meditation is kind of good for you. And people stay around, even though we continually talk about how what this is about is not that. It's about universal liberation. It's about pouring the energy of your life into supporting everyone so everything can be better. But this going towards suffering or going right where it is a part of the practice. And we can learn to do it when we're sitting. You know, if you sit for 20 minutes, some people like this never really happens. They're just like, oh, just chill out. That's okay. Actually, you don't like have to have some special cathartic experience. But for some people, even sitting for 10 minutes is really afflictive. And that doesn't mean you're doing it wrong. It means you're knowing how you are. You're going to the reality of suffering, that it happens to be there. And if you come here for Rohatsu Sesshin and you sit for 2 or 5 or 7 days and you just float on a cloud of pure presence, that's cool. But the people who've been here are laughing because they know that oftentimes that some difficulty arises. It's not a torturous practice. It's not a martyr practice. It's not a trying to gain suffering so you can get rid of it or something. It's just it comes up. If you renounce the things you hold on to, all your self-protective systems, you'll see that there's suffering in the world. You'll see it's in you. You'll see it's out there. The prince renounces this shell of privilege and steps into something else. Zazen trains us to do this. Or when we practice Zazen, we just experience it. And that develops our capacity to do it, to be present. So, this puts me in mind all this, you know, the prince just like going right where the suffering is and just like hurling himself into the whole problem. It puts me in mind of a piece of writing by Bell Hooks, who once wrote, "The practice of love offers no place of safety." We need some safety. Everybody here has ego needs. So I'm not recommending that everyone just immediately go home, sell your house, give away all the money, and, you know, I don't think that's going to happen. At the same time, we can continually challenge the structures that produce the enormous amount of protective privilege that we have. So we were talking about this, kind of dismantling privilege from within. Someone, maybe they would enjoy it if I used their name, but I didn't ask them, so I'm not going to. But someone in our group was talking about how they're now practicing, just if there's a person asking for money, like a person panhandling, they just give them some money. They're practicing just giving the person some money. And the person who's doing this practice was talking about how a lot of the practice was giving them the money is like, you know, if to the person talking, it was like a dollar or two is not like a big deal. If I give away that much money, it's not really going to impact me that much. But what the reason that it's hard to do it is it's an uncomfortable interaction. So privilege, we are both imprisoned by the privilege, right? Because we're like, oh, I can't look over there at that person. Or it would be uncomfortable to actually have a real human interaction. That's alienation. But in order to move past it, there has to be the gesture of going, oh, I'm uncomfortable. It's kind of weird giving you the money. Is that right or wrong? And I'm still privileged, so you're actually more acknowledging it. Give the money. You're pointing out that it's real because you're going to walk away with your bank account. And that person is going to walk away probably into a much less economically advantaged situation. So, another way you can challenge your privilege is by talking about racism, talking about sexism, and talking about classism, just acknowledging it. So it's impolite to talk about it, and that preserves it. So, like, there's probably people in this room who are already unhappy that I mentioned it. Maybe not, but usually there are. That's because to talk about it at all is the beginning of being able to challenge it. So the king doesn't even want to talk to you. It's not like, hey, Dad, what about the prisoners? Son, have some steak. You know, that's you don't want to have that conversation. The prince says, I'm going to have the conversation. So now I'm just talking about things that make everyone not like me anymore. So there's this thing called the Impossible Burger. Anybody had an Impossible Burger? Okay, I don't want to advertise the Impossible Burger. But it's a thing. So anyway, these people use this really fancy science to make a veggie burger that is like meat. And it's a lot like meat. I have eaten them. So they're fun to eat. But anyway, it's like a really complicated process. They're highly branded. They have a very complex and developed marketing strategy, and they're going to permeate the world. Anyway, it's really unlike any other vegetable burger you've ever had, in my experience. It's like so meat-like, it's weird. But anyway, one of the things that the guy who founded this company is kind of like, these solve all the problems through technology type of mindset. He says, we can't ask people. He says, well, meat eating is incredibly harmful. And this is well established. So, of course, in early Buddhist thought, it was harmful because killing people for your own pleasure is not good. Pretty simple, right? They're sentient beings. You're killing them so you can have something that you enjoy. That's inherently harmful. But in our context, you can also look at how the average U.S. citizen's carbon impact would be reduced by 10 to 15% if they stopped eating meat, which would actually get really close to meeting the kind of long-term carbon impact targets that people who say we could actually reverse massive climate change, what we need to do. So it's like a kind of a big deal. It's like, wow, systemic harm that I engage in by just eating this thing. So anyway... This guy who formed this company that makes the Impossible Burger likes to talk about this. But then he says, we have to make this kind of thing that I've made because we can't ask people to give up what they love. He says that, it's like one of his tag phrases. We can't ask people to give up on eating what they love. That's like really sad. It's really sad. It's okay. You don't have to hold on to all this stuff. Freedom is not acquired. So I called this talk, Give It Up for Freedom. You know, like, give it up for freedom! Yeah! I feel that. But give it up. Liberation comes not through gain, but through surrender. Then the queen shows up. Don't kill my son. This like has a, you know, the real mythic power. The dad's like, yeah, I'm just going to kill you. The boss, you know, sounds familiar. Call Freud. Hotline. Anyway. So the queen manifests this compassion. Don't do this punitive, harmful, angry thing. And, you know, the queen, is her compassion is kind of distinct from the prince because his is so so big. His view of what it would, who it would be good to pay attention to is so big. And his willingness to give up, you know, he gives up all his, he's like gives up his wealth and his retinue. And actually in the story, he goes on to say he just becomes a mendicant for the rest of his life and then becomes this lady with the long name who doesn't have any stuff. But, so we're like this though. You know, sometimes our compassion is kind of narrow. You know, it's like we just, there's one person. And that's, it's good and human. And we can't actually reach a bigger kind of compassion, I don't think, unless we're able to have that with, in the smaller frame. So we have to learn this just with our families and with ourselves. I'm reminded, though, so there's, like, the king wants to do this harmful thing, and the queen intervenes. And it couldn't help putting me in mind of Ananda and Mahapajapati. So in the original order of Buddhism, it was only men were allowed to be ordained. And, you know, women were allowed to practice, and Buddha said women can attain realization, but they weren't allowed to be ordained. By the way, ordination principally involved giving up all your material possessions and becoming homeless. So that's what Mahapajapati, who then became the first ordained person, I'm giving away the ending of the story, and was also the person who raised the Buddha, she wanted to be ordained, and he's like, no, not going to do it. Not gonna do it. There's kind of, the story gets very long, and you know, he has reasons, blah blah. But she then initiates one of the first, as from my knowledge, one of the earliest recorded acts of large scale civil disobedience, where she gets a whole bunch of other women who want to be ordained, and they just start walking around behind the Buddha. Because he, like, travels, all he does is he walks around India begging for food and living in the forest. And so they just, like, follow him around. It's awesome. And, anyway, at some point, Ananda, who is biologically related to both of them, but is also Buddha's devoted and loving attendant throughout his life, says, yeah, Buddha, you gotta listen to her. He intervenes. He steps in and is an ally. And this is transformative. Just like in this story where the queen intervenes. So, well, what if we give him a couple weeks? We'll see what happens if we actually just take care of people instead of attacking and harming them. So we can do this. We can, when we see something happen, we can go, hey, we can walk beside each other and help each other along. So anyway, this story is pretty dramatic, but this story is really basically about how everyone has the capacity for liberation. Everybody in the story moves forward along the path. Even the people who were just consumed with their punitive tendencies, they have an ability to learn. We have to trust that people are like this. And I will say that, you know, maybe it's, I don't know how you're taking it, but maybe it's kind of challenging. This guy just gives up everything, throws his life away. Well, how am I supposed to even meet that? Well, let it work around in here. Let it be a little challenging. It doesn't mean you have to be that, or if you're not that way, there's something wrong with you. It's just you let the literature, the tradition rub up against you and see what happens, see what comes out of it. But I want to close with a couple lines from a poem called The Song of the Grassroot Hermitage. And this poem is ancient, but it probably has some historical accuracy. There was a person named Shurtou. He probably, because Buddhist monks had been doing this for a long time, lived with almost no possessions whatsoever, having given them up and just moved to live outside. And let me just recite some lines about how he describes what it's like. I built a grass hut where there's nothing of value. After eating, I relax and enjoy a nap. When it was completed, fresh weeds appeared. Now it's been lived in, covered by weeds. The person in the hut lives here calmly, not stuck to inside, outside, or in between. Places worldly people love, he doesn't love. Realms where people love, he doesn't love. Though the hut is small, it includes the entire world. Then he goes on for a while, and towards the end he says, let go of hundreds of years and relax completely. Open your hands and walk innocent. Thousands of words, myriad interpretations are only to free you from obstructions. If you want to meet the undying person in the hut, don't separate from this skin bag here and now. Thank you, Shurtou. So I will invite people to lift their voices up in question, comment, story, or song. Yeah.
Surely it didn't escape you that there's some similarities between Jesus Christ and the young man.
No. No. It does seem like, yeah. That's true. Yeah, back there. He said, surely it didn't escape you the similarities between Jesus Christ and the young man. Mm-hmm. Yeah, go ahead.
The lady was following him around, kind of Mary Magdalene, Ananda, kind of St. Peter.
Wow, it's cool. I'm getting a biblical education, finally.
Okay. So after you told the story, you mentioned that all of these different prisoners were actually represented in the story, meant to represent the various aspects of our personality or of our character. It reminded me that Katagiri often said, talked about the emotions, sensations, impulses that we had and felt. He called them living beings. And I found that that has been very helpful to people who can't figure out how to be okay with that which they think is harmful and negative. But when you think of every one of them as living beings, you know, you want to be kind to a living being, you know. And I I think it seems like such a simple teaching, but it can be so powerful. I also think that stories like this, rather than calling them mythical, I think mystical actually fits in a little better, because it's very counterintuitive that we come across, say, some bitterness that we feel, and the way we approach that in our teachings is to open up to it completely, give it all the space that it needs. So we're so used to thinking, well, it's just gonna blow over. But that's actually how we find our liberation, and I think there's something very mystical about the way that works.
Mystical stories. Yeah, I just want to highlight that, recognizing or thinking of every aspect of your experience, particularly those feelings, thoughts, emotions, as living beings. Everyone complete. Beautiful. Yes.
Yeah, thank you. Some really interesting points to ponder on.
If you can use your voice loud, that will really help. There are people far away.
Can you hear me back there?
There, thumbs up.
So, I love the idea that the prince, so this youth, this representation of youth, is going up against maybe that section of us that is older and more set and fearful, and is encouraging that side of ourselves internally to free that which imprisons us. So all of those individual prisoners representing all the different components that we lock up, which I think is, it's really quite beautiful and liberating. And I enjoyed your reflections on like focusing on one to liberate. And sometimes, I mean, with the stories, sometimes you don't have to analyze that one component to liberate, to just liberate. There's a real sense of freedom just to let it all go, which I want to thank you for your snippet, the story about your work in prisons, incarceration centers, and that you didn't even know why they were incarcerated. You know, and sometimes we have all these different things in us that are imprisoned, we put in there, or maybe, not to blame, but maybe, you know, just others put in there and we accepted it, or whatever. So it's interesting. Sometimes you don't need to know. You can just let it go.
Sometimes you don't need to know. I'm feeling that. Yeah, liberation. You know, something good to think about, liberation. One time, Reb Anderson was here. Someone's like, you keep talking about liberation. What does that mean? He says, that's liberating people from your ideas about them. So that is really, from a Mahayana perspective, that's really the bottom. That's what the Heart Sutra is about. It's liberating things from your limiting conceptions. So this isn't about like, God, go fix it for you. Something much broader and more open. Yeah.
So like in the story, if we're saying like the prisoners are like our feelings, they didn't just like need to be set free. He also needed to like give them what they needed. So what would you say that we like need to like give our feelings?
Deep and abiding love. Yeah. Yeah. Yeah, and sometimes maybe there's an external form. So, like, if you're really angry, it's like maybe you need to go for a walk or, like, move your body around, right? Or, but at the bottom, in this tradition, there's a huge emphasis on just offering pure non-judgmental presence to the emotional state itself, and that is profoundly healing if you begin to trust that process. And that's true externally with other people as well, to meet them with that. So we should probably wrap up. It's wonderful to have a chance to practice with you guys this morning, you folks. Use better language, folks. My friends, that's the best language. My good friends on the path, thank you very much for practicing today.